Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast in Ukrainian Studies. I'm your host, John Shetichka. Joining me today is Alina Nichik. Alina is a postdoctoral researcher in the European Politics Research Group at ETH Zurich. In addition to being a scholar, she is also a busy social activist and has done much for Ukraine. Today, we are going to be talking about her new book titled Ukraine Vis-a-vis Russia and the EU, Misperceptions of Foreign Challenges in Times of War, 2014 to 2015, out from Ibidem Press in 2023. And it has a very nice foreword by the scholar Paul Denary. Alina, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And, you know, thank you so much for writing this book on foreign policy, Ukraine, the EU, Russia. I think that this was released at a really integral time, of course, not only because of the full-scale invasion in 2022, but of course, the longer war that started back in 2014. So I wanted to ask you sort of a general question to start, which is, you talk about the relationship between the EU, Russia, and Ukraine, really with sort of an emphasis between 2014 and 2015, as your book says. And I'm curious, you sort of make a really concerted effort and a good one, I think, to talk specifically about Ukraine's role and the agency they have in their foreign policy ambitions between both EU and Russia. So I want to ask you, what was the purpose for you to write about Ukraine specifically during 2014 and 2015? And what were you hoping to do by centering the focus on Ukraine's foreign policy goals?
Thank you so much for this question. So I have been dealing with EU-Ukraine-Russia relations for many years already, even when I was doing my bachelor in Kyiv. I was looking at it historically, like Ukraine being between the West and East. And I was then my master thesis was about Ukraine's integration in the EU. And when I was finishing my bachelor, so annexation of Crimea happened and the war started. And then I wanted to do a career in academia because getting knowledge and sharing it with others is the most important for me. And I mean, this topic just came out. So EU-Ukraine integration, and then the war started because of Ukraine's geopolitical choice to join the EU. And I was in the beginning, so I was shocked that the war was happening. Now, obviously, we have this invasion and it's much more horrible. But still, the annexation of Crimea and Donbass, and I was so shocked. You never expect a war to happen in your country, and I was In the beginning, I was thinking why the world would not stop it. In the beginning, I was thinking about general topic like global governance and how we our international cooperation failed to stop wars. But then, you know, when you start doing PhD and you look for PhD positions and you are making some choices and make a topic more narrow. And I started also reading the literature, and I noticed that yes, there are some scholars who are studying Ukraine, but the vast majority of them, when they were studying Ukraine, they were studying EU-Russia, West Russia relations. They were not studying Ukraine, Ukraine's own actions. And you know, Ukraine is very often even politically deprived of its subjectivity, actorness, and I found that there is almost no studies on Ukraine's foreign policy. There are some people who study Ukraine, they can study language or culture, but exactly looking at Ukraine's foreign policy, there was almost nothing. And now after this invasion, it's already more. But at that time, is that war and all the scholars who were looking at this annexation of Crimea and the war in Donbass, yeah, I would say 90% of them were looking at the West-Russia relations and then how this war is happening from these relations. So they were not looking at what Ukraine was doing and how Ukraine's foreign policy was influencing all the situation. So I found this gap which I wanted to look at, and I wanted to show and to understand what was the influence of actually Ukraine on these relations, and to look at Ukraine's foreign policy. And I often get this critique that people say, oh, you're criticizing Ukraine, but Russia is to blame. I think it would be interesting to write a book just to say Russia is an aggressor. Everybody knows this. So I wanted to study something different and to look at good, bad things, involvement, improvement of Ukraine's foreign policy. And I think it's very important. And I think it's good to study. And also as a Ukrainian, I mean, there are not so many things how I can influence Russian politics or European Union's politics. As a Ukrainian citizen, I can change my country. And I think it's important also from this perspective, what we can change and to understand, to show it to the world. And I do show in my book that Ukraine did have influence on what was happening. And all the negative things which I found, it gives us opportunities to improve then foreign policy. And I think it's very important for Ukraine as a young democracy and still developing, developing its foreign policy. It's important that we understand it better and we can develop it then as Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful to hear. And I really think that this book should be on every policymaker's desk, because there has been a shortage, it seems like to me, of people who continue to see Ukraine only through the US or perhaps through Russia or US studies and Russian studies. And they've sort of, you know, I think sandwiched Ukraine in between the two, but your book does something different. It offers a perspective that isn't just focused on Russian foreign policy, although you're not afraid to talk about those who, you know, who have studied Russian foreign policy and their views on Ukraine. And, you know, you have some challenges and pushbacks to people like Marsheimer and others who have written about, you know, foreign policy in certain ways. And so I think that, you know, really highlighting Ukraine's foreign policy and the agency and Ukrainians and Ukrainian policy makers and making these decisions is really important. And I think it will set a precedent for books to come written on the topic in the future, for sure. So I guess my next question is, the book it focuses on some decisions that policymakers in Ukraine have had to make in regards to their foreign policy with Russia, the EU, and of course others, but really you're focused on this sort of trifecta of EU, Russia, Ukraine relations. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you see as some of the failures of Ukrainian policy from, let's say, sort of independence in 1991, because this is sort of where you start in your book. You have a nice lead-in chapter that gives a brief history of foreign policy decisions from independence up until about 2014. So I'm curious if you could highlight what you would think, or I guess what you would say, are some of Ukraine's foreign policy decisions that were made in good faith and turned out to be decent decisions, and those decisions you think that were sort of ill-advised and lessons that they would have to learn later based on events that would happen, not only with Russia illegally annexing Crimea in 2014 and starting what is now the Russo-Ukrainian War, but then also having to deal with the full-scale invasion in 2022. So I'd be interested to hear in a brief way what you see as some of these foreign policy interventions from Ukrainians, ones that you think were quite good, perhaps, and ones that you think perhaps were not.
Yeah, I think it's a lot to answer this. Very briefly. So theoretically, I chose some elements from game theory, and I was analyzing foreign policy through this rational decision making and game theory elements. And I was looking how, according to this my game theory framework, Ukrainian politicians were able to analyze situation before making each decision, to analyze their foreign policy partners, and I was looking at Russia and the EU. And from this framework, and then from making interviews and analyzing different documents, I saw quite a few irrational, but there is nothing perfect in this world. So I was just comparing this with the perfect model, of course. But you know, some of my interviewees, for instance, people who were working foreign analysts who were working with the government in Ukraine, or some journalists, they were saying that Ukrainian politicians lacking common sense and not being able to analyze their foreign interlocutors very well. And I remember also that I heard that before this war, before 2014, Ukrainians did not have experience with foreign policy. So that before it was mostly transactional relations, that to sell, to buy something, but not strategic foreign policy, strategic relations with different countries. How when you form them, you plan, you think about your advantages, disadvantages, how you can build these long-term relations. And then this crisis happens. Yes, there is annexation of Crimea, the war on Donbass, and one of the things which I found that they basically did not have crisis management experience. Yes, because there was no war before. And then during this 1 year, which I was analyzing, they were developing understanding of what, for instance, preferences of Russia and the EU were, and how they were able to use their resources in Ukraine, what were their strategies. And so I see this improvement, but I would say that quite often Ukrainian decision makers in foreign policies, they just have this, okay, we want this, and then that's it. And they're not looking at what other actors want, what are some advantages, disadvantages of Ukraine, what Ukraine can offer. And for instance, when the annexation of Crimea, the war in Donbass was happening, and they were so offended that the EU and the world did not come to save Ukraine. But they were not trying to convince why Ukraine is relevant and how, because it was like understandable for them. And for instance, I remember one of the former Ukrainian foreign ministers told me that European Union is impotent, but you need to do something. That's the work of foreign policy, to convince others why you want to get something from them. From my research, I got that they did not have this very much understanding. Oh, for instance, regarding Russia, and I still see it, it might be very interesting, I still see it now with this current invasion. And in my book, I compare, in epilogue of my book, I compare the first year of the war with the first year of this full-scale invasion. And I still see this, for instance, see it also from EU politicians that all fail to understand Russian interests. They may be against international law, but you need to understand and analyze them. You need to understand what Russia wants. Russia is a neighbor, Russia is there, and it will not disappear. So, I mean, you need to understand the realities. You need to understand what your foreign partners want, what you want, what you can offer, what your as Ukraine, what your good and bad things, and you need to analyze all of this, and not just okay, I want this, and we go and we shout to the world that we want to get this, and that's one thing. I mean, I would call it lack of professionalism. I would name it. Another thing that, there is corruption in Ukraine and there is this influence in foreign policy. So some political actors in Ukraine, they follow their personal preferences. Then maybe they were not able to achieve foreign policy preferences of the whole Ukraine because they're following preferences and trying to get the most for their political capital, trying to make some corrupted deals, or trying to think about their future elections, which may also happen in other countries. So that's not something, but so I would say this lack of crisis management experience, which was developing, and lack of good analysis of foreign policy preferences of their foreign interlocutors, and also corruption. It was, and still it's one of the indicators. I can name it that they're not patriotic enough. I can call it as this as well. It was a bit long, sorry.
No, it's great. I mean, a lot of good points there. And I mean, this is something that people have been having conversations about since February of 2022 is, Ukraine's sort of foreign policy experience. And a lot of people have pointed out that it wasn't extensive. And there's been a lot of talk, of course, we haven't talked about 1994 and the Budapest Memorandum and, decisions that were made there and whether this would have, made a difference in the war that is raging now. And agreements made in the 2000s that gave Russia access to the Black Sea, which of course they're using for their fleet, which they're using in the war now as well. And so there's been a lot of points that people can, sort of gesture to in the history of these relations of whether Ukraine's foreign policy understood what was at stake in some of these decisions. Now, you also make an argument in your book that the Ukrainians perhaps believed a little bit too much in the EU and were sort of disappointed when they didn't step up, as you mentioned earlier, and help them in the war. And there was a belief in the EU. And then you make the argument in your book that after 2014, after Russia illegally annexes Crimea and then occupies Donbass and starts this war, that the sort of belief in the EU helping Ukraine starts to diminish a little bit. Can you talk a little bit more about why Ukraine had such a strong belief in the EU and what they thought it would offer? And then maybe you could talk a little bit about what happened there and why that relationship broke down a little bit.
Thank you. So yes, that's one of the points which shows this improvement of Ukraine's foreign policy. So they learned that the EU will not come with its army because the EU doesn't have army, and they learn it only when it happens. So regarding Crimea, I got it information from a few respondents. So that the EU actually promised to solve the situation with Crimea and ask Ukraine to do nothing. So there are some other reasons why Ukrainians did not protect Crimea. Like, they didn't believe also that they would have enough army, enough opportunity to protect Crimea, but they also heard this from EU. So EU promised to solve this situation. And then when something started happening in Donbas, Ukrainian politicians already understood that, okay, we did not react to Crimea, and the EU did not help, so we need to do something ourselves. So it shows very clear that there is this improvement of understanding. Why there was such belief of EU? First of all, and that's again this unprofessionalism. So I discovered that many people, I mean, I did not talk with president, so maybe, and a few people mentioned that some analysis was at very, very high level, but at least that at the level of ministries or Ukrainian parliament, many people they didn't understand what EU is. Some people are saying me in members of Ukrainian parliament, they interviews, they were saying, but no one taught us about EU. We did not know what EU is. Yes, so some people were just lacking knowledge about EU from Ukrainian side. And it's not only the problem of Ukraine. EU also has a problem with its international communication. EU misleads also sometimes. And for instance, even now with perspective for Ukraine to join EU, sometimes EU also mentions that it's possible in a few years, which is also not possible. And at that time, EU was also, many EU politicians were going out and saying, yeah, we'll help Ukraine. This is wrong. What is happening? And Ukrainians are taking this at face value, or some Ukrainians. And I mean, it's also for other parts of the world, it's very hard to understand what EU is. So when some Polish politician come out and says that what Russia is doing is wrong, it's illegal, we will support Ukraine. Then in Ukraine, some people think that, yes, EU is coming with their army, but it's just one politician not related to EU. And so some ambassadors of different EU members countries to Ukraine, and all these different people from EU member states and different levels, and the EU politicians, they were seen as EU, and what they were saying, it was taken at face value and understood how they wanted to understood it. So there is issue of knowledge about EU and issue of EU foreign miscommunication. But I would like to mention that, for instance, the biggest point in the first year of the war, 2014-15, it was this invasion of Ukraine with the Russian army for the first time in August 2014, and then Minsk won. And I remember that one Ukrainian politician told me it was a cold shower to Ukrainians, because they understood that Russia is ready to use all its resources to reach its aims in Ukraine, and the EU is not ready to support more. EU is ready to do some sanctions, but also the biggest sanctions happened when MH17 was shot and the European citizens died. Still, I mean, the sanctions that we have now after Russian invasion, they were incomparable with what was at that time. So it was everything was very symbolic. Then Ukrainian politicians already understood, yeah, what is happening, who can help and who can't help. But at that moment, it was already too late. Crimea was occupied, yes, and parts of Donbas were occupied. And also, yes, Ukraine did not have that much resources itself. Like, we know how Ukrainian army was almost destroyed, and how these voluntary battalions were forming during summer 2014. There are different factors that were influencing the whole outcome. So I would not tell any counterfactuals what would happen differently, but just that, what was understanding of Ukrainian decision makers, and how comparing Ukraine's foreign policy with this ideal picture of how foreign policy, rational foreign policy would be.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned Crimea several times there, because Crimea has been central to the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, but also now in this larger war, it continues to be of major importance. And, you know, you probably saw just yesterday, and in fact, I tweeted it, that, you know, the Russian government is now trying to rewrite Soviet law about the transfer of Crimea being illegal during the Soviet period. And so this continues to be a problem for them. And your book, I just wanted to highlight that I think it does a good job of stressing the importance of Crimea, you know, and other scholars, and I think of people like Rory Finnan and others who continue to, you know, draw our attention to the centrality of Crimea and all of this. It's really important. And your book also shows the relationship between Crimea and foreign policy as well. And so I'm glad that you highlighted that. So, the other thing that you mentioned too, so we talked a little bit about Ukraine's, you know, maybe they had too much belief in the EU. And I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about how many MPs, also didn't really understand what the EU was. And so I assume that there's some trickle down effect with that too, of they don't understand quite what it was, or they didn't. And then, you know, the rest of society sort of looks to their leaders about what the EU is, and maybe there's some misunderstandings there. We did talk about that, but I also want to ask you too about what about Ukraine's foreign policy and their understanding of Russian aggression? You make another point in your book that Ukraine underestimated that Russia would put the resources it has and wage this war. Can you talk a little bit more about what you see as some of the foreign policy failures in that regard? Why was Ukraine so unprepared to understand that Russia, in fact, would use everything it has to invade and occupy Ukraine?
Yes, in before 2014, it was majority of Ukrainians and Ukrainian decision makers, they couldn't believe that Russia would attack Ukraine and do anything against Ukraine. It was at all levels. I mean, this Ukrainian soldiers in Crimea, even a few days before invasion, they were given interviews that no, I'm 101% sure that they will not attack, because we even trained together with them. It was in Crimea there was this Russian fleet, and they were so integral there with all their holidays and all these parades in Sevastopol, and it was part of Crimea already. And obviously in Soviet Union, so many Ukrainian and Russian militaries, they were training together, and these connections were very, very strong. And so it was impossible even for the army, yes, to understand. Then even such things that connections between Ukrainian and Russian oligarchs was so strong, and they were making this illegal business on Russian gas, and illegal connections between oligarchs were also that people could not believe that they would destroy these connections as well, because it was so beneficial for others. Then on a personal level, people had families and friends, at least in Eastern Ukraine, like it was normal to go to Russia to work, or all this, and cultural connections, exchanges. I mean, it was so much of this. It was not just, it was not possible believe, and you never believe that the war can come, of course. And with Crimea, I would like also to mention some mistakes of during all years of Ukraine's independence. So the Crimean Tatars were protesting that they came back after after Ukraine's independence, and the land was taken. I remember as I was a child, always saw this protest of Crimean Tatars in the TV, and the Ukrainian government did not do much to help this. And Crimean Tatars as a force, the most, how can I say, yes, the indigenous people of Crimea, and so the most patriotic force, maybe I can say, in Crimea, and Ukrainian, all the different governments in Ukraine, they were not taking care of giving them more opportunities and supporting them. So there were all these Russian youth organizations, political parties, media, everything in Crimea also. And there were a few situations before the annexation of Crimea. During in the 90s, there were different situations happening there, and the Ukrainian government wasn't that attentive. So, I mean, it was, at least regarding Crimea, it was very visible, very possible that something can happen. And just all 20 years before the annexation, more than 20 years, Ukrainian government wasn't paying attention. And talking with my respondents, with Crimean Tatars, they all say that, who are now Ukrainian politicians, Crimean Tatars, they all say that the Ukrainian government did not think about Crimea at all. So it was everything was there. And then there was this misunderstanding of lack of analysis of other actors, as I also mentioned. So it was lack of analysis of interest of EU and lack of analysis of Ukraine's biggest threat of big neighbor Russia. Yes, a lack of understanding of what Russia wants, how Putin wants to stay in power. And I also mentioned that his personal preference was and still is to stay in power as long as possible. And his support rating was falling, and he's just saw this opportunity. There was total no analysis of this. If there was analysis that it's that Putin is looking for something to boost his rankings, that how important Ukraine is for Russia, then they could have done something different. And as for Putin also, I would like to mention many of my interviews and analysis show that Putin is not a strategist, so he has his goals, yes, but he's a tactician. So he just saw the opportunity. So he saw that something is happening and he can use this propaganda. Okay, Ukraine would go, that Ukraine can go to the UN, NATO, Crimea would be taken, and it's relevant for us. And he could use it, he could take Crimea, and he could boost his popularity, and he used it. Then he started this in Donbass. He was starting it also in Odessa, in Kharkiv. Okay, it did not work. Okay, we concentrate on Donbass. He was changing the strategy very quickly. And this was also making problematic for you and for Ukraine to react, because he was so quick. And it's another thing that he's the one decision maker. In Ukraine, there are a few decision makers. In the EU, it's many, many decision makers. So this time, the issue of time was also very important, that he was quick to catch the opportunity and to do, okay, here, there. And one European analyst told me that Putin is so good in punching below his weight. So he's just catching when something has come out. And Ukrainian politicians, they did not analyze what Russia wanted. They failed to understand even, I mean, Crimea is such a clear example, because yes, there are so many things that are happening. And I mean, even Russian parties and then during Euromaidan, so that support for Euromaidan in Crimea was less than in other parts of Ukraine. And all these months of Euromaidan, so there was this less support for Euromaidan Crimea, and Russian media and Russian parties were working there. And then in a few days, Crimea is annexed, but it didn't happen in a few days. And also, this is what my interviews were saying, that even in Donbass, during Euromaidan, they started some Russian organizations were starting coming out. And so it was... Although, as I said, Crimea, Putin is a tactician, he's catching the opportunity, but still it's not happening in one day. So there were things which could be, obviously, if Ukrainian decision makers were fully rational with all the time and perfect information and everything, that would be possible to do. I'm comparing it with this perfect situation, but I understand that no one is perfect, but still, we should go there. Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's a fair criticism. I mean, I think this is what good scholarship does. It sees, you know, multiple points of view. And I think that it's one of my favorite parts of your book is you don't shy away from some of the tough conversations about some of the foreign policy failures that have existed. You know, and the underestimation of what Russia could do. You know, when I was reading about this in your book, and you make several points and use good examples of, you know, I remember being in Ukraine in early late 2021, early 2022, and there was a belief, you know, when I was there among my colleagues and friends that no way that Russia would invade, you know, despite the fact that they had been building up on the border since spring of 21, despite the intelligence that the US government was giving Ukraine, there was still an nobody really thought it was going to happen. And I looking back on that after reading your book, it got me thinking about, you know, perhaps there was a there is some foreign policy gaps here in understanding what your neighbors are going to do. And you need to understand, as you said, that they're there and they're not going away. And so you need to understand that they're going to make some decisions. And I sort of felt that, I guess, being in Ukraine at that time in a very volatile and very transformative time. And one that, of course, took a turn for the worst when Russia started the full-scale invasion. And with that, I want to sort of pivot, you know, as we approach sort of the end of our talk here today, is now that the full-scale invasion is ongoing, I'm curious what foreign policy from the Ukrainian perspective looks like now, now that we're into the full-scale war. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on, A, what does foreign policy look like now because of the war? And do you think that Ukraine has learned any lessons about foreign policy after enduring, you know, a few years of this in the full-scale war mode? And if they have learned any lessons, what do you think they are?
Yes, obviously there is some learning, but I mean, it's already late because the worst is happening. Russia has invaded and you cannot change anything. And obviously Ukraine, also before this invasion, Ukraine could have prepared a bit better, yes. And as you say, there was no belief. And now Ukraine is fighting as much as it can. But now Ukraine is in war with this huge Russia, with all its partners in Asia, Africa, and Middle East. And now it's already not much what you can do. As for foreign policy, I mean, yeah, still there are some issues and in Ukrainian diplomacy, yeah, not all ambassadors are the most wise people who should be in their place. So there are still not fully professional people who are making these decisions, I would say. And I think, yes, there is already better analysis of what Russia wants because everybody already understands it. But there is not that much. Relations with Russia were broken. And they were totally broken only after this invasion, not before. So before 2022, Ukraine still had relations with Russia, although Crimea was occupied and Donbass, and there was a war in Donbass. And now Ukraine made it pro-EU, pro-NATO choice, and which is part of my current research. And that was one of this Ukraine final decision that Ukraine goes to EU is one of the reasons why you took this seriously and gave candidate status to Ukraine, opened accession negotiations. Because for many, many years, Ukraine was between the EU and Russia, and it was this sitting on two chairs was also problematic for the West to understand whether Ukraine wants it or not. Now the vast majority of people in Ukraine want the EU and the NATO membership in all regions of Ukraine, majority of people wanted. I would say the biggest development is Ukraine's civil society. You asked about foreign policy, but It's interesting, but civil society became also part of Ukraine's foreign policy. For instance, my current research on why Ukraine got candidacy status and in this 4 months of convincing EU, Ukrainian civil society and politicians, they united in all countries, Ukrainian diaspora, they were organizing different events, they were meeting with local politicians, they were doing everything. Ukrainian civil society in Ukraine, they were and still helping the army and also trying to control Ukrainian politicians so that they implement EU reforms. So Ukrainian civil society is amazing. And if you talk about the war, now it's 80% of Ukrainians. Can you imagine 80% of Ukrainians in one or another way help Ukraine this war? So someone is fighting in the army, someone is donating or fighting in informational space. It's unprecedented, and it's a positive thing in Ukraine's foreign policy, and hopefully that more of this patriotic and professional people will be involved in actual decision making. And there are still some issues. There is, I would say it's interesting, at least in the beginning of the war, you might remember how Ukrainian politicians and the president was asking for support from the West, sometimes shouting at parliaments and sometimes being so not that diplomatic, and it did work. So this different foreign policy instrument, it did work in the beginning, and Ukraine got more support in the end. So it was innovative instrument in foreign policy, I would say. And there are issues that stay. I mean, corruption is still there. And but it's hard because the invasion is going on and everything is so... It's very hard to assess it now because it's not that much that you can actually do. And I would say, Ukrainian foreign policy would benefit from more professionalism, I would say. Now, regarding relations with the EU, it's also they do not have full understanding of what the EU is and, for instance, how this accession process will work. Also, we hear this in Ukraine that in 1-2 years we can join EU, which is totally not possible. Even if everybody was ready, everybody was willing to do it, even not possible technically to do it in 1-2 years. So there is still lack of understanding of EU, and we are candidates for EU, so they need to learn at least about EU better. But it's already much better than it was in 2014, obviously. I would say it still should be more strategic foreign policy and more understanding of Ukraine's strengths and weaknesses, what Ukraine should offer. And now it is already, because the war in Ukraine is such a threat to security in Europe. And even when... when doing my current research and asking people in Brussels why Ukraine got candidate status, many even do not remember how Ukrainian politicians were trying to convince the EU, because there was this understanding, okay, the war is happening, we should help Ukraine. So now it's so obvious, because that's why it's very hard to assess it now. But there is always space for improvement, more learning about other actors, more professionalism, less corruption, I would say, would be the same pieces of advice for me for current foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of work to be done. And, you know, to Ukraine's credit, they're doing a massive amount of work right now in extreme circumstances. And it's going to be very difficult for, you know, this new foreign policy sort of vision to take shape while they're at war, right? And it's going to take some time. for that to, they're going to have to reevaluate all these things, of course, when the war ends, and we hope that sooner than later, and they will have a, you know, a task before them of what they want post-war Ukraine to look like in terms of foreign policy. And so, you know, just to for our, you know, our listeners that are probably thinking, yeah, you know, there's a lot of work to do, but it's also really hard to do these things under war, and especially when your neighbor keeps provoking you. But I like your points about civil society. I'm glad to hear them mentioned. I think Ukraine's doing a lot in that regard. And, you know, I'm in communication with a lot of those folks that are doing great work, and they've sort of become ambassadors in all kinds of cultural and social ways across the world for foreign policy on behalf of Ukraine. And I think that's a really important point. So the last question I want to ask you is actually about the cover of your book. And our listeners here cannot see the cover, but they can quickly Google your book and get on the IBIDM website. Would you mind sort of describing the cover of your book? Who is on it, and what is happening?
Thank you so much. So in the beginning of my book, I actually mentioned this. This picture was painted by a cool artist from my home city, Sumy, Konstantin Shipta. Also mentioned his website with his other pictures. So he paints some allegoric pictures, sometimes of naked women, but very some deep sense always. I saw him once. I visited once his exhibition in Sumy, and when I was preparing my book publication, I was thinking, what should I put on it? And I thought maybe I could contact him and ask him to do me a favor. And yeah, he agreed to do this. He painted this picture especially for me. I told him, I sent him my title of the book, explained the main idea of the book. So he did it specially for me. And it's a bit of promotion for him. Maybe some of people will visit his website and will be interested in more pictures. I think he's very talented. And from my home city, Sumy. And so my book is EU-Ukraine-Russia relations, but focusing on Ukraine's foreign policy. So you see Ukrainian hetman, so the symbol of Ukraine. And you see it's on the front, so it's the main figure, so Ukrainian hetman making decisions. And since it was analysis of strategic decisions and foreign policy, so I put this like chess that they're playing, because game theory, and and he painted this. And I mean, everybody can understand, can recognize Putin there. Putin, and he's playing not the rules. He's holding the knife. Oh, yes, so he's cheating. It's possible that he will mislead. He will cheat. He has this nuclear sign that he has also nuclear to scare the world. And he's from Soviet Union. This is a symbol of Soviet Union. He's a KGB officer. And on the back of this picture, that's the West or EU, because at least in 2014-15, they were mostly like watching and not involving. Also, they were like standing from Ukraine's side, like supporting Ukraine. But I think it was most Putin EU so far, and so without faces. I think it was more his perception. Because in Ukraine, there is, now it's a bit different, but at that time, there was a strong perception that the EU did nothing. I mean, when you go to Brussels, you hear that, oh, we do what we can. But in Ukraine, was this perception that the EU almost did not help Ukraine at all in this first year of the war. So I think it was the perception of Ukrainian public that the EU are standing and watching.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. It's a fantastic picture. I just wanted listeners to get a little bit of a history behind it, because you do talk about it in the book, and those who know their Ukrainian history well will recognize some of the themes in there. And as you were talking, I got all of the symbolism, except for I didn't realize the chessboard and game theory. I didn't put those two together. So I think that's really clever. And it's a fantastic piece, and everybody should look up this artist, because it's great. And I really think it highlights the themes of the book well. So I want to finish this by reminding our listeners that I've been talking to Alina Nichik. We've been talking about her book, Ukraine Vis-a-vis Russia and the EU, Misperceptions of Foreign Challenges in Times of War, 2014-2015, out through Ibidem Verlag Press in 2023. Alina, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It was very interesting. And for me, a self-reflection on my research and on current situation was also helpful for me personally. Thank you.